Well, thank you very much. That would be the future of Samba file serving anyway. I'm Jeremy, if you don't know me, I'm one of the original founders of Samba. I work at Google in the open source programs office. They fund me to work entirely on Samba and go and present Google at conferences and things like that. So going from the clouds, which is where SEMO was, we're going to be going down into the plumbing at the bottom. So this is, I'm between you and going home, so I will try and stay on track, not take too long. And what I'm going to talk about is something that's pretty technical. It's about the internals of Samba. It's going to talk a little bit about how what we have at the moment and how we intend to move forward, how we intend to change the code in order to meet the performance requirements of SMB3 running over the various different transports that are coming in, and essentially how we're going to keep modernizing the code, refactoring it, in order to stay relevant. And of course, that really means going asynchronous. So how many people actually remember, was anyone else here for Tridger's wonderful talk about, oh, yes, there's a few people anyway. So I saw him give this talk. I don't know whether he gave it here or whether I was in Australia at the time. But he was talking about the various choices you have when you're trying to do asynchronous programming. And if I may quote him here, threads are evil, processes are ugly, and state machines drive you mad. And so you really have to pick one of the three, or do you? But it is a very ugly set of choices. But it's part of the problems with dealing with the complexity of trying to do multiple things at once. And of course, being Samba, we managed to do all three simultaneously. And as poor Picard would say, why would you do that? Well, hopefully this talk is going to explain a little bit about why we ended up doing that, what the advantages to various parts of this are, and how we can get ourselves out of the mess, hopefully. So, to start with, so let's think about using processes. So, really, we have a heavyweight process architecture, one process per connected client, and we've kind of always been that way. Modern, newer implementations generally try to be multi-threaded instead. Things swing back and forth between them. The original multi-thread implementations were much worse than the single process Samba model. Threading has gotten a lot better, and people have gotten more used to it. So the process model is, we're kind of there because that's where we started. One process per client, single connected TCP socket. It's, for us, I think, and especially looking back on the code, it was a pretty good decision. Had we tried to do things multi-threaded in the beginning or with a state machine, we would have been evil or gone mad. And I don't think we would have been as successful as we are. So essentially, it allowed us to learn, somewhat having training wheels. So the things about processes are, one, they give you immense robustness. So you've got one connected process per client. If that thing dies, then the client will reconnect. You haven't broken all the other file serving connections on the machine. Depending on the underlying OS, they actually give you pretty good scalability. Obviously not as good as threads can give you, but because of the kernel memory mappings you have to have. But they do actually give you a pretty good scalable architecture. To the mid-level. They don't take you all the way up to the high end, and that's what we're trying to achieve. Another thing that Volker pointed out to me when he was reviewing these slides for me is that the fact that we have a process architecture with a great deal of separation between the clients is what allowed CTDB to be easily created and the clustered Samba to be easily created, or more easily created. Because essentially, we were already we were already used to having separate processes communicating with each other. And so extending that out to talking to a cluster server was actually a lot easier than we had to tease all that code out of a state machine or out of threads. And the other nice thing that it gives us is security separation. So we can actually have a separate Unix process credential per connected client. And even now, I believe Linux and Windows are the only OSs that can have separate credentials on a per-thread basis. We don't run on Windows very well. We used to, but I don't think we run great on Windows now. We actually have started using separate credentials per thread on Linux, but we don't depend on that. So for portability's sake, again, having a separate process allows you a great deal of security separation. So if you're trying to get something going and you don't want to deal with too much code complexity, having a separate process is a great way to do it. It's nice and isolated, it's easy to code, single-threaded, you know what you're doing and the next thing follows the next, if you know what I mean. So, where are we? Dum-dum, did that move? Or maybe I need to press CMO. Got me to use, there we go. Oh, I pressed it twice, sorry. There we go. So what are the downsides? Well, as I pointed out, they're too heavyweight, they're too big. Having a separate process when you're talking about tens of thousands of connections just overwhelms machine resources. They're just too big for that level of scale of services. So copy and write issues. It was interesting. I was watching Amity's talk on. Did I get your name right? Sorry. Yes. He was here. Is he here? Never mind. Ah, yes. There. I got your name right. Right. Yeah, cool. His talk on CTDB, and it was interesting. They found that the actual fork cost quite a bit, copying the VM mappings. It was interesting. My understanding was that the fork was actually reasonably cheap. Copying the VM mappings was reasonably small, but what was expensive, I'll get to you in a second, but what was expensive was as soon as you split off a fork and you tried to do anything, as soon as you touched the malloc areas in glibc, you got a bunch of page faults where you had to do the actual copies of the pages because you were changing the free list or... Anyway, CMO, yes?
Let me give you a hard time. We already discovered that in SMBD, and that's why we architected this pool SS daemon and other daemons to start very, very early. We had to change some of the Samba stuff to make those start very early before all the TDBs were opened for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, if we forked all those daemons after the TDB were open, we would then pay forever.
Yes, this is, and this is one of the mitigating things that you have to do that you don't necessarily think about. Well, so if you didn't hear Simo's comment, was basically, it's spawn your processes early, because once you've got a great deal of state and copied VM mappings and malloc pages, then when you fork and try and do something, you're going to take a bunch of memory page faults that you don't want to take. So you can have cleanup issues. You guys probably don't remember in the early days of Samba, we could occasionally leave lots of what we used to call SMBD droppings, zombie processes lying around. So you've got to reap them. And of course, if you want to share anything, you have to use pretty heavyweight IPC processors, IPC mechanisms between processors. TDBs are quite a nice way of doing it, but there's you have to go through some kernel mechanism to synchronize. So it can be quite heavyweight. So what are the other options? Well, let's look at the other common choice, which is using threads. So we actually started using threads by accident, like most people do, actually, because they're hidden in some library somewhere. And if you saw my talk in 2002 about asynchronous I/O using threads, I first coded it up. I thought, oh, here's this POSIX async I/O interface. It's been standardized. Oh, look, glibc implements. Let me code up so we'll be asynchronous. So I coded this up, threw it out over the wall to the community and said, hey, look at this. Aren't I great? We have asynchronous I/O now. And so some of the vendors tried it out, and they came back to me and they said, it's slower. I'm like, how can this be? It's async I/O, it's async. Should be faster. And then it turned out that I investigated glibc, and someone who should remain nameless, but I think now works for Goldman Sachs, had people in Red Hat know who I'm talking about, implemented the AIO inside glibc using threads, and he decided, for some reasons better known to himself, because I pushed him on this, and he first started answering my questions, and then when I asked him this very specific question, he just stopped answering the email. He put a limit on one outstanding I/O per file descriptor, which is the dumbest design decision you could ever think of, because that's not what you want. And the other thing it does is it loses signals, so you have racing. Anyway, so there's many, many interesting things that can happen with threads. It is very, very efficient. It's an ideal way. You can create a thread pool. You can eat as much CPU as you can be given by the underlying OS. Very lightweight, where you don't have to do any kernel VM mappings. It's not like a fork. And actually, we do use threads for some blocking system calls. And we actually use it via a couple of abstractions that Volker created. From the fertile mind of Volker and Lendecke, called pthread pool and ACES. And the idea is you use ACES, which calls down, builds a pthread pool underneath. And all of this really nicely happens without you having to think about it. So we actually very efficiently use threads these days. So the joke is that the pthread pool abstraction even works without threads, which is kind of cool. So if you're on a system that is so old that it doesn't have threads, you can still make pthread pool calls, and under the covers it just does everything synchronously. But the great thing is, and this, I mean, you have to admit this is genius code, it uses the same API. So it looks as though it's creating threads, even though it isn't. So I was very impressed with that. But so we use threads, but we try and use them through these abstraction layers, and I will explain why we do that a little bit later on. By the way, if anyone wants to ask any questions or make any comments, please feel free at any time. So why do threads suck? Well, it's like using C++. You know, everybody thinks it's a good idea until you get people who don't know how to use it, and then it's a horrible mess. And threads are the same. It's everybody thinks they're a great idea, and everybody thinks, yeah, I can program threads safely. It's that other jerk over there. He always gets it, or she always get it wrong. And that happens to everybody. So you end up with this monstrous complexity. And there's a lot of shared state in Samba. And you know, it would probably be a similar project to sort of making the Linux kernel thread safe. And they started out with a big kernel lock, and we haven't quite gotten there yet. So we might end up going there, but it wasn't designed this way. Samba really wasn't designed to work this way. And if we decided to say, okay, we're going to go threaded, we would go away for 3 years and come back with something that probably worked about the same as what we have now, except that it would deadlock a lot. So that would be a rewrite. Rather than a retrofit. And you know, if there's anything I've learned from working with Volker and Metz and everyone, the idea is to keep the airplane flying while we're replacing the wings and the engine, you know? So the goal is we add threads under the covers, and then eventually, after a few years, we might find that everything's magically thread safe, or at least most of the things we care about. So Ganesha, the user space NFS server, is very interesting. I've taken a look at their code. So they have issues with running as threads because, at least with POSIX pthreads, which is what they depend on, you can only have one user ID per process. Even though that's not true on Linux, and it does some disgusting things internally to actually make that appear to be the case. Yes, glibc again, as Seema points out. If anyone wants to know the full details, they can grab me after the conference. It's a very interesting code. Very clever, but one of the reasons why you can lose signals. Anyway, Ganesha runs as root, and one of the things we depend on is accessing the file system under user credentials, not running everything as root. So it's really interesting to watch what Ganesha has to do when it's creating files, for instance. So they're running as root, they don't become another user because they have a thread pool underneath, a fully threaded server. So every file or directory in Ganesha is actually created as root. Yes, comment.
With GPFS, Ganesha is using a special call into the GPFS file system to pass the credentials. Because obviously it doesn't work with the POSIX layer. It directly goes through API.
So you have a special version of Ganesha that cheats because you have a special kernel. Okay. that's always an option, of course. But when you're trying to write portable code and you don't have special hacks in both the kernel, your file system, and the code, then you have to. So, and what Ganesha does, the generic Ganesha code, is actually creates everything as root. And of course, for directories, that's particularly ugly because they then have to open it and check that nobody symlink or move race them in the meantime. It's vastly ugly and evil code. I guarantee that if we tried to do this, they would be CVE security announcements up the wazoo. For a long time until we got it right, and I'm not sure that Ganesha actually doesn't have race conditions there. It looks safe, but I'm not really a security expert. But it's really, really tricky code. The other thing that it makes utterly impossible is POSIX ACL evaluation. Now everybody dumps on POSIX ACLs and says we want Windows ACLs, we want Windows ACLs. But in fact, out there in the world, there are an awful lot of people still using POSIX ACLs. Not as many as are using Windows ACLs, but there are a lot of people who use POSIX ACL, and Ganesha simply cannot evaluate and create ACLs correctly because they're doing this. Well, obviously on GPFS they do it right, but on a generic system without those root level hacks, without those kernel level hacks, you cannot do ACL inheritance correctly with a threaded root running user space file server. So threads are evil, as Tridge so famously said. So what do you got left? What's the last cup of hemlock we've got to drink? So state machines, and that's where you end up after you've decided that your processors are too heavy, your threads are just a malevolent. There's like sticking your hand in a bag full of ferrets who someone's kicked. You're gonna get bitten with threads. So what you end up with is state machines. Hey, it's a Northern English thing. they have contests where they put ferrets down their trousers. I kid you not. I grew up in a very strange place. So you end up with state. we end up with state machines, and state machines. You try and manage the complexity by essentially breaking it up, doing things in parallel in small. Understandable, digestible chunks. So you're only ever processing one event at a time, so you're removing all the locking and deadlocking headaches of threaded code. You make everything non-blocking so that you start something going, and when you've filled a socket or there's nothing else to be read, if you're writing and you fill the socket or you're reading and there's nothing to be read, you go and do something else. The other really nice thing, and again, this is something that Volker pointed out reviewing the slides, of an advantage of using a state machine is that they are usually, not 100% of the time, but for most of the things you're trying to debug, they're completely deterministic. So if you get a bug in one pass through the code, it's very likely, unless there's subtle timing differences with timed events, that you're gonna get the same sequence of events processed in the same order the next time you debug the code. Whereas with threads, you have no guarantees on that. You're completely at the mercy of the scheduler. Whereas state machines tend to be a little more deterministic and therefore a lot easier to debug and find problems. So just as an example, Volker did some great messaging, new messaging code. Turns out that in his initial cut of the code, he reordered two events. So we were actually processing incoming SMB3 events, and we were answering them in the wrong order. Now, it didn't actually matter. Windows and the client would have worked the same way, but it triggered one of our tests. So I had to go in and find out what was wrong, but it was completely reproducible and deterministic. Every single time, I got the same bug in the same test in the same way, and that was what enabled me to go in and actually work out that, oh, when he's rearranging this array, you need to keep the same ordering rather than move some pointers around. Trying to do that with a threaded system would have been difficult, to say the least. So it depends. State machines, you really don't want generic programmers doing state machines. You want to have a good state machine implementation underneath and have everybody use that and put a big label on it saying, here be dragons, do not mess with this code unless you understand it, kind of thing. And so the choices that we had, there was libevent, there was libev, which is a fork of libevent. But of course, in the Grand Samba tradition, we're like, no, none of those are good enough. We'll write our own. There are actually reasons for that. I'm not being so facetious, but. So what we ended up with was T-Event. So why did we choose T-Event? So libevent didn't handle signals at all well, didn't integrate with signals. And that was a big deal for us. Our entire messaging system was based on handling signals reliably. Yes? Ah, yeah. So Volker pointed out the main reason for this is we have to do POSIX real-time signals. The op-lock breaks were not passing the file descriptor that was being broken. And essentially, we couldn't get the data that we needed in order to process the signal correctly. So eventually, this ended up as writing our own. And I've looked at libevent. Ours is nice. Ours is, in some ways, theirs is nicer. In some ways, ours is nicer. And the other thing that T-Event integrates with much, much better than libevent and libev is it's fully integrated with Talloc. And that's really nice, because it means that you can call Talloc free on an event, and all the state with it and all the stuff you've set up, it magically goes away. It deregisters itself from the event subsystem. It's a really nice API to use. It is massively underdocumented. In fact, if you look at Richard.
I was going to make an observation. So after struggling with trying to do things in a threaded fashion and running into problems with T-Event, I managed to convince an ex-Microsoft guy who worked on MRX SMB1 to use T-Event correctly for what he was trying to do.
Ah.
And it stopped crashing.
Oh, that's very cool. Hooray! So it's a nice library. It's well designed. But I am going to say it's massively underdocumented. It needs a good tutorial. In fact, because I was looking at the SSD wiki, and one of the things it has is a wonderful little Talloc tutorial, and then the T-Event, it says, we need a good tutorial for this. And if you look at the T-Event wiki, it's, yeah, we really need a good tutorial for this. So good programmer documentation is sorely missing on this. It's really nice. It's really elegant. It allows things that libevent doesn't allow. Libevent exposes much more of the underlying weight subsystem than T-Event does. T-Event has a wonderful abstraction, which was actually done by accident because Tridge decided it was much more elegant to be able to wait on both reads and writes, and we've originally used Pole, and the Pole interface allowed you to do that. When Pole, it turned out Pole wasn't scalable enough, we went to ePole, and then I have a version that uses Solaris ports. It turns out you cannot add multiple file descriptors into the big vector in the kernel that is being looked at. So we actually have to have an abstraction layer that Metz and I worked on quite hard to get working that allows you to have separate callbacks for read file descriptors, separate callbacks for write file descriptors. But it really does help abstract out the code. You can basically say, okay, all my read path goes down this set of functions, all my write path goes down this set of functions, and they're completely separate. You don't have to have a callback that says, oh, hang on a minute, was my file descriptor ready for read or write? Therefore, do this, do that. So it's nice, it's elegant, uses epoll, so it's very efficient, and I'm planning in my copious free time to write a FreeBSD KQ version that will, at that point, for the three main systems, we'll have the most efficient mechanism of having events dispatched to us. So how does it work? How do you use it? So has anyone ever looked at T-event code? How many of you have noticed that every single variable is called rec? All of them. Everywhere. Oh no, we have rec and then subrec and then, yes. So as you'll notice, the little subtitles, a variable called rec, it gets worse as we go along. So the way you're supposed to use this is you create a XXX, whatever X may be, functionality send function, which ends up calling tevent request create inside, give it a state structure, that's what the event state you're going to have hanging around, returns you an opaque pointer, which is your handle into the event subsystem. Then you add a completion callback to that pointer, which is by convention, whatever it is you want to do, done. And then you schedule the asynchronous operations and you return back to the main loop. And at that point, you can go and do something else and the magic will happen. As they say, a miracle occurs. So when the asynchronous event completes, you call from your asynchronous operation finish, you call tevent rec done, which then triggers the completion callback, your foo, whatever it is, xxx done, and xxx done calls xxx receive. Again, these are just names by convention. There's no hard API, there's no rules for this. And that then returns the results of the operation. And then you free the request structure and the operation's over. You've completed, you've gone back to your main loop, you've returned, hopefully you returned data to the client or triggered the timer operation or whatever it is you wanted to do. Now, so that's a nice easy mechanism, an easy way of using it, one request, one reply. Real world doesn't work that way. Especially when you are implementing something, when you're having to map POSIX semantics onto Windows. So you've got a big Windows operation, create file, that's going to create a file, it's going to check the security descriptors, it's going to open something. So you want each of those sub-events to be asynchronous. So you can actually do this by splitting the request. So you schedule one asynchronous event. In the callback for that, when that first part's completed, you schedule another asynchronous request called subrec. You essentially chain them together. This thing can get as deep as your rabbit hole will go. You can do as many as you like. And as each of them complete, it'll travel back up the stack until you've finished. As each event is completed, it calls back up the chain. So more variables call rec. It handles just about any kind of event you want. It has timer functions. You can set events to go off after a certain amount of time. It does completely lossless signal handling, which is something that I don't think any of the other event libraries do. I think some of them try and do it. I don't know whether they actually succeed or not, because we've always depended on ours. File descriptor IO, which as we are have non-blocking sockets, it means that the read path for the main SMBD server essentially just gets notification that something's ready to read off the socket, reads as much in as it can, sees if it's got a complete packet, if it is dispatches. If not, it just goes back to the main loop and will get called again when there's more to read. And then these are things called immediate events, which are from somewhere down in the stack hierarchy. You want to have a callback that basically says, run me next. This is important, but I need to be called at the top level, and they're called immediate events. And I think Amity talked about some of those getting in the way when inside CTDB. The other thing that's it's actually got several uses. The main one I remember was my first use of that in anger was in the bug I worked on with Ira when he was at MathWorks, where this was actually the weird Windows bug where you put together change notify and a cancel back to back.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, and so what would happen is we couldn't process the event, even we put it on the queue. So we put the event on the queue,
right.
But when we got the cancel, essentially we couldn't take it off the queue because it hadn't begun yet.
It needed to depend until.
Yes, so at that point we said, okay, we'll call ourselves back with a T-event immediate. And that way we know we've gone back to the main loop, the event will have really started. Now when we cancel it, it's really gone. Once around again. So that's what events are for. And then there's something which is from the deepest pits of hell, aka Metz's brain, which is T-event queues, which allows events to be queued from within the event main loop. And you probably don't remember, if you're not on Sam, technical, but Metz and I had this blistering argument about an API I wanted to introduce. And he managed to point out to me eventually that this could be done with the existing queuing API, which caused me to actually go inside T-Event queue, which, if you've ever played Call of Cthulhu, lost me sort of 3d20 sanity points from looking at that code. It was very, very dangerous code to look at. And in fact, it did in fact do what was required, it just depended on implementation detail, which is why I hated it so much, but still. So it has queuing APIs, which are massively undocumented, hard to use, but they are there. Hopefully that will get better. Not as in the APIs are bad, they're not bad APIs, they're just undocumented and very, very subtle. So they just need very good documentation, I think, that's all. And as I said, the downside to this, all variables call rec. So it's used inside Samba, SSSD, CTDB. They're the is there anyone else who uses this? Does anyone know of any other? OpenChange uses it. Oh, cool, I didn't know that. Oh, so that's,
no?
Okay, they don't. Oh, they have more sense, fair enough. So yes, it is only the three ugly stepchildren. Samba, SSSD, and CTDB use it. So the problem is, oh, yeah. Oh, okay. So I'm actually wrong. So the comment was that CTDB actually doesn't use it directly. It uses kind of the prequel library, which is the underlying event library, but without T-event rec. There's only two users that you can look at for examples. So this is the problem right now, is people coming into the Samba code, they open a file, they see every single variable called rec, and they close it again and go, I don't understand this. Witness the poor guy who turned up on the mailing list recently who said, how do you write something to a file in Samba? How does this get done? I've been putting trace points everywhere I could see that's called write, and none of them get called. How do you do this?
There's actually a story behind that guy, because every half a year he comes on server call, asks these questions, gets polite answers to the documentation and source code, and comes again in half a year asking the same question.
So Alexander's comment was, this guy turns up every 6 months asking the same questions. Well, maybe it's another alias for the Steves, whoever they are. For people who don't know on the list, we have an alias called Steve, which is either one person with the worst case of multiple personality disorder I've ever seen, or an alias that expands out into about 20 to 30 people who each post under the alias Steve. It's very complicated. It has a lot of rules. These rules are not written down. Again, documentation would fix this. It's very easy to get confused, to get wrong when you need to use T-event rec done post error and how you use this and in what order. The only saving grace is that whenever you use them wrongly, Metz will turn up on the list and say, you did that wrong. So there is always that. Yes. 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 He's like minus W all on GCC. Yes.
So the other upside of it is that code using TventRec pretty much is immediately understandable because it looks like all the other TventRec code. So I mean, so once you manage to wrap your head around it, and I agree that the activation energy required for this is quite high, but once you manage to do that, you look at a piece of async code and you immediately see how it works, because it works just like every other piece of async code that we have in Samba.
Yes.
Try doing that with Node.js code, and
yeah, that's a very good point. Once you have loaded that into your brain and you've gone fully nuts, then you stay nuts is basically the way, and you can work with it forevermore. Yes, John.
Jeremy, I don't think this code is usable. There's no T request vehicle.
Oh, you're missing that. That's in a variable called rec. Anyway, so the best guide is you have to load this code into your head. It is monstrously complex, especially the queuing piece. It's just not as dangerous as threads. There's a non-natural code flow to it. That's the other problem. Is essentially you have to get halfway through a function. It's a little bit like writing cooperating functions. Fibers or the cooperative threads. You get to a certain point and you have to remember, hang on a minute, I'll save everything and call myself back. Once you've gotten that in your head, it's not so bad. So how is it currently used with the Samba VFS? So the main users and the ones I would recommend looking at are the pread send and pwrite send. This is what the poor guy who was trying to find the right path could not find. The old SMB1 code has a different mechanism that doesn't use this. The SMB2 plus AIO code natively uses this. It's very clean, it's very elegant. The SMB1 code is essentially in maintenance mode. So, you know, we're leaving those interfaces alone and just building on the SMB2 plus stuff. So how do we need to use this in more areas? So our VFS, and this is where Richard, we need to talk with vendors. Essentially, all of our blocking calls, the read and the write, obviously the main important ones, but all of the, and fsync, I think, is done. All of the blocking calls need to have send-receive functions inside the VFS API. And in fact, you can actually wrap the blocking calls using this by in the same way that.
Yes. And it will make it possible for us to return status pending.
We can already return status. In fact, we already do return status pending after, I think it's 500 milliseconds on the reads and writes. I checked the code recently. So we need to do this for many, many more of our internal VFS functions. And then the second part of it is the main actual file server pieces, the open code paths, every potential blocking point, we need to split into the state machine T-event style functions where we go back to the main loop. And that's trickier than it looks, but it's a doable problem. It's not like trying to find every shared state variable and put locks around it, which would take us a very long time. This at least can be done piece by piece. Going through the code, so we can make more and more stuff asynchronous. Yes, Hamity.
Using TventRec allows you to get rid of nasty nested event loops.
Oh, sorry. So the comment was it allows you to get rid of nasty nested event loops. I never understood nested event loops in the first place. So this is something that was just. I looked at that and thought, I'm not reading that code. I don't even want to know how that works, which was lucky because it was in the ADDC, so I didn't have to know how it worked. But it gets rid of a real mistake, I think, that we had in the code, which was these nested event loops. So what's one of the other problems? Sorry, I do like the thing. It's one of my favorite movies. It's a really important issue. There's a massive bear trap in the middle of T-Event when used inside the Samba VFS, and we get away with it for now. And I know Max is aware of this because I've seen some code he wrote over it. When you defer an event and you get a rec handle back and you go back to the main loop, and then the event completes and you get called back, you may not be running under the same UID that you were when you scheduled it. So what that means is when the completion function calls, so you set the blocking call going as one UID, but when you get called back, you're actually now another UID. Now, for the ways we're using it now, it doesn't matter because all the ways we're using it now are on handle-based calls, actually, except for the calls that Metz and I worked on, which is user log off and disconnect, tree disconnect. So that's a very bad thing. So imagine, because occasionally when you get called back, especially for things like the close path, where you might have to emulate delete on close. So you've closed a file, but now you have to go and delete it. So you were running as user thread, but when you get called back for the close, you're now running as root. Oh dear. If it was set delete on close, thread may end up deleting a file that thread shouldn't have been able to delete. That's a bad thing. So right now, you have to be aware of that and store state manually. So essentially, you save off the full token list and restore it. You become the user on the way back when you've been called. Now, that the only example of that right now is the async logoff and tree disconnect code path, all of which have to be done as root. Metz has some code and a flamethrower for the dog thing up there, where he integrates the saving off of the UID into the tevent libraries. But Metz can talk later on or you can grab him over a beer or something to find out what the state of that is. But that's something we're going to have to solve. So how you shouldn't do it. This code is, there's some really, really clever, and I know because I wrote it, tevent rec code inside open. Do not emulate this code. I pushed it through over Metz's strenuous objections, mainly because it worked and he didn't have time to do it properly. And I was still learning tevent rec at the time. I would not do it again this way. It does something unbelievably ugly, in that it actually hacks the internal state of tevent to allow a full request to be pushed onto an asynchronous queue and restarted from scratch, whilst reattaching the request to the tevent rec pointer. This is, yes, it works. Hey, Simo, it works, don't knock it. The reason it was done that way is we already had an asynchronous interface for SMB1, deferred opens. And that was working, fully tested, robust, and essentially that's the easiest way to plug into the interface that we already had. But it is disgusting and will eventually go away. So if you want to look at how to do it properly, look at the SMB2 asynchronous read-write requests. So, how does it actually use all the cores that you have on the system? So at the bottom level, you spin off an ASYS call which has a pthread pool, which is Volker's thread pool abstraction attached to the main tree ID connect structure. So within Samba, you end up with processors which have multiple tevent requests which contain asynchronous contexts attached to a certain tree ID, which internally have pthread pools, which you simply don't see. So from the rest of Samba, you have all this threaded code going on that you are not aware of at all, which is the ideal way to use threads in my opinion. Because each of those threads is doing one blocking system call, one raw blocking system call. And then, of course, you have all the other bits and pieces. You have the file descriptor events, which take care of the outflow of data to the client and the inflow of data from the client. You have immediate events to go once more around the loop. You have the signals for the mechanisms coming in from the kernel for op-lock breaks. And then you have timed events for various housekeeping or, you know, sort of wake me up if I haven't processed this SMB event in, you know, 30 seconds or something. So it's a complex brew. And one of the things you never, ever want to have to do is to go in with a debugger and walk the event queue list and try and figure out what's going on. And nicely with tevent rec, you don't have to do that. Normally, you only attach yourself to the debugger once you've been called back, so you only have to care about one call chain. Because if you ever tried to go through the entire call chain for everything that's going on at one time, then you would be confused. I have been many times. So, overview, why we ended up doing that way. So we start out with a heavyweight process, functional isolation. There's the async client socket coming in and out of the T-event main loop with file descriptor events, which I'm not showing there. Each of those turns into an SMB2 or 3 event, which is a T-event request. That dotted line boundary there is there's a different share connection, a different tree ID. Each of those requests on a particular tree ID share an asynchronous context inside of which is a pthread pool that actually does the blocking calls that actually do all the work. And then out the back there, we have another thread pool which handles the messaging subsystem, which this, by the way, I'm describing code that has not yet shipped to customers. This is 4.2 code. The messaging subsystem in here is Volker's new messaging subsystem, which uses UDP, which uses Unix domain sockets with a thread pool attached that will basically massively scale our messaging. So it should make communicating with CTDB a lot better. And then you've got your housekeeping time events underneath. So last slide coming up. Make it so, Mr. Landecki. So you really have to understand T-event if you're going to be proficient at Samba. And so we really need good documentation, and we need to be very friendly and helpful and nice to people who turn up on the list saying things like, how do you write a file? It's going to be the way we're going to be handling things. It's going to appear in more and more places. And at least as Kai says, once you've loaded this stack into your brain, at least it's consistently crazy. You know, you look at the code and it all looks the same, which is what you want. So T-event is a wonderful middle ground until we reach nirvana, if we ever get there, which is completely thread-safe code, which I'm not sure that is nirvana, but it's one of those things that you can aspire to even if you don't actually get there. And the more we use this and the more code we create using this, we'll end up, it'll get easier. The process should accelerate in migrating the rest of Samba to use this this idiom internally. And it'll be easier to teach people. People will get more used to it. And I'm hoping, because it is a really nice, elegant library, which is probably one of the most efficient ways to talk to thousands and thousands of simultaneous socket connections, I'm really hoping that this will get picked up by more projects, possibly the ones that use Talloc, who can feedback, help us find bugs, and make the library better, and eventually spin off into a separate library, just like, I think it's already spun off as a separate library, but it's still in the Samba tree, whereas we really want to make these eventually, ultimately, in the same way that C Wrapper grew up and ran away from home, we kind of end up wanting to have T-Event and Talloc do the same kind of thing. So I think that's it. Yes. So does anyone have any questions or comments we didn't get to? Chris.
Just a detailed question on the work Metz is doing to keep the UUID available when you get the callback. Is that going to be genericized so that the library isn't tied to UUIDs, or how is that mechanism going to work?
That's a really interesting question. I think the code, well, Metz can answer that probably better than I, so.
No, just speak up. No.
Give him the microphone, don't torture him.
So the idea is that we will create a wrapper T-event context, which abstracts this. So we will have a special T-event context on the connection struct, and one for the root context and the main one. And then whenever an event is scheduled or registered in the event context, we register the event in the main context and register a special glue callback. And that will just run become user or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's what it would be.
Okay, there are two more questions, comments, and I think we should.
Oh.
Richard first.
Yeah.
So I think what that this suggests as well is that the concept of a kind of a two-layered VFS is going to be needed here, because I think you need asynchrony in the functional layer, the layer that's trying to provide NTFS semantics, but the poor old OEMs out there.
Forcing, it'll blow their heads up.
Forcing them to operate in the same environment is not going to be easy. But since there is a thread, kind of a thread pool abstraction down below where you can put blocking operations, they can generally operate in that layer with synchronous calls.
That's an interesting idea. We might end up having to go there. I am not looking forward to having to teach OEMs how to write a T event VFS module. So, and
I was just going to follow up to Metz. I need to get a better understanding of what he described, probably. But it just seems to me that one of the things you could do when you're passing a callback routine, you could also pass in when you create the event, generic user data that could be whatever it is,
that's what will be stashed with it that is then used to change context. That will be a context associated with it. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
Any more questions?